Welcome to the Carbon mini-series within the Exploring Opportunities podcast, brought to you as part of the Future Farming Resilience Support delivered by NIAB, AKC and Savills, working in partnership. My name's Elizabeth Stockdale, head of the Farming Systems team in NIAB. And today we're going to explore practical tips for reducing carbon footprint on farm in livestock systems with my guests Richard Simpson, Sarah Bolt and Christina Ford, all from Kingshay. Welcome. Richard, do you want to just start by giving us a bit of a background to Kingshay? My background is as a soil scientist, so I'm really pleased to have some proper livestock scientists and consultants on the call with me today. Do you want to give me a little bit of background on Kingshay and your work and interests in this carbon thing?
Yes, thank you, Elizabeth. Hello, everyone. And yeah, many thanks for the invite to be involved today. Kingshay are a team of livestock specialists. Most of the work we do is with dairy producers. We, over the last sort of 30 years, have been doing a lot of sort of herd monitoring, which has evolved from monitoring cost of production through to herd health monitoring, and particularly in recent years, increasingly monitoring sort of carbon emissions. And there are a number of projects we're involved in that have seen a sort of particular increase over the last couple of years, with a greater focus on carbon emissions, particularly with working with some of the big milk processors. You know, as the whole importance of carbon has come on the agenda, particularly with the now the sort of requirement for food processors establish their scope 3 emissions.
So we've already started the classic of lots of different kinds of terminology thrown at people. So we'll just backtrack a minute and just do that carbon on farms, because actually it isn't just carbon on farms. There are different kinds of emissions, different kinds of gases. So if we look at the work that you've been doing, based on that, where are you seeing the carbon on farms? In particular, where are those emissions coming from and what kinds of emissions are there?
Okay. Well, in terms of the emissions from livestock farms, and say with the work we're doing, it's primarily focused on cattle and dairy cows. As ruminants, the biggest area is methane emissions from the enteric methane produced from the ruminant, and also the methane produced in manure. So yeah, methane tends to sort of account for, you know, about 60% of overall emissions, and that is then followed by resource inputs, so particularly purchase feed inputs, and then fertilizer inputs in terms of imports onto farm, and then fertilizers then have emissions in terms of the use in terms of some of nitrous oxide production. So those are sort of the majority of the emissions. And then finally, there's the from a carbon point of view, within a dairy farm, the smaller inputs of fuel, electricity, that are evaluated in terms of, their carbon dioxide emissions.
Okay, so those ones, I guess, are the ones that are the true carbon emissions. The others, methane and nitrous oxide, are expressed in terms of their carbon and added up to give us those that overall carbon footprint. But if we're going to take that into account, Sarah, we also need to recognise that there's also some carbon stored already on farm.
Particularly in our soils. So it's thought that the UK soils store about 10 billion tonnes of carbon. And to put that into perspective, that's approximately 57 times the UK's greenhouse gas emissions back in 2007. So we're storing, or have the potential to store, such a lot of carbon within our soils, and we really shouldn't forget that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess there's also things like, and particularly in livestock systems, those barriers between fields, if they're hedges or trees, those can be quite big carbon stores too.
Definitely. So I never remember the figures for that, but certainly our hedgerows do store a lot of that carbon. And obviously we hear a lot about how planting trees will help store carbon on our farms as well. So not to be missed, certainly.
No, and I think one of the things about the new SFI payments is that they're really helping farmers look again, aren't they, at their hedges, to score them, to think about hedgerow trees, and to really think about managing hedgerows. Less at the moment around soils in SFI, but an opportunity to manage, to monitor, and to think about organic carbon and its store in soils.
Certainly, I think sort of under the soils parts of the SFI, we're looking at grant money to be able to measure organic matter. So that gives us a direct correlation with our soil organic carbon. So we're sort of looking at something around about the 60% of soil organic matter is carbon. So it's that it's knowing what our organic matter is, we have a really good idea as to what we're storing in our soils within the way of carbon.
Excellent. So a really good opportunity for farmers to kind of take stock of that and to understand what the store they've got alongside the emissions. Christina, I've often heard it said that if we're more efficient in the way we produce things, then we'll actually have lower greenhouse gases. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, and especially in particularly of dairy's work that I've kind of focused on, in improving efficiencies means that, you know, you've got healthier animals. So if you've got reduced mastitis and things like that, they're much more efficient. They're going to utilize the feed more efficiently. And then they'll be on the farm for longer as well. All helps to reduce emissions overall.
There is a little bit of a suggestion that going faster to slaughter in terms of the young stock is actually a good way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But I think there's a bit of pros and cons on that. Is there a way we might want to think about using grassland perhaps differently? Or is that just not a nice, simple solution?
I guess it's having a think about the carbon costs of purchase feeds versus the carbon costs of growing our own forage. So you could potentially say that a slightly slower grown animal that is grass fed would have a lower carbon impact than an animal which is perhaps fed a high imported feed, particularly a high soya or other high carbon footprint feed. So I think that sort of in simple terms, that's quite a good way to look at it.
And I guess there are other things we need to think about as well as carbon. So if we think it might be about animal welfare or we pasture fed livestock and meat quality might also be part of those conversations, not just carbon. So it's important not to just be or simplistic and think about just one thing and be driven only by those carbon conversations.
Absolutely. We do a lot of work on biodiversity as well. So looking at the whole ecosystem of the farm and sort of all sorts of parts of sustainability. So you've got social sustainability, getting the general public on farm and showing them what you're doing and kind of selling that story about, you know, working with nature rather than against nature and that side of things.
If we kind of go back to some of those big sources of emissions, we've got our animals healthy, we're managing them. And keeping their welfare at high levels, so their health status is good. I think, Richard, you said that nitrogen fertilizer was potentially a big source of emissions on livestock farms. In a grassland system, I guess we've got an opportunity to perhaps integrate more legumes into the system alongside the grass than they might do in arable systems. But there must be pros and cons of doing that. Is that something that we should be looking at more?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at Kingsay, we've been doing work with clover and sort of mixed grass clover lays for 30 years now and have shown sort of clear benefits in including clover in a sward, not just from the nitrogen producing potential of the clover, but it also increases intakes. So including sort of 30% clover in a sward can increase intakes up to about 2 litres per cow per day. So there's benefits there from an efficiency point of view. And then, yes, provide the clover then has the potential to produce nitrogen. I think it's important to say you've got to give clover the opportunity. If you add a lot of bag nitrogen, then the nodules won't necessarily develop to be able to produce the nitrogen. But yeah, clover, and I think we've seen over the last couple of years with the significant rise in nitrogen prices, then from an economic point of view, farmers have looked to use nitrogen more efficiently, and clover is one of the legumes that's been a valuable tool to achieve that.
There's a lot of conversation around herbal lays as well at the moment, and those even more diverse wards, they potentially have benefits for biodiversity, but are they also possibly a tool in this space?
I certainly believe so. I think sort of just incorporating even just a single white clover into a soil that's perhaps got a lower than average soil carbon will actually help increase that soil carbon. But actually then increasing the species diversity will actually improve that carbon sequestration even more. So there's a real correlation between the number of species within that sward and the amount of potential carbon that can be sequestered. So whether that's where we're looking at perhaps some of the herbs that are deeper rooting are able to act in that way and get down deeper and really sort of sequester that carbon deeper as well. But it's really looking at that range of species. Certainly we did some research back in 2020 having a look at the soil carbon in various grassland glades, and there was a very much a correlation between the number of species within a lay and the carbon within that soil. And it was just sort of, again, that's been proven not only by our research work, but by various other researchers across the world. So I think it's really important to actually think about some of these herbal lays and the job that they can do in both sequestering carbon, but also being more efficient with our fertiliser usage and everything else.
And also being more resilient. You know, we've seen in recent years more challenging conditions, particularly dry summers. Going back a couple of years, you know, this area in Somerset particularly was very dry. And those grassland farmers with herbal lays, certainly that helped them through that challenging period.
And I guess a transition to herbal lays doesn't mean all swards. It can mean, you know, just a small proportion. It might be about focused on dry cow feeding or integrating into a system, not just turning the whole system over away from perhaps high performing grassland to take some areas into those more diverse, not necessarily less productive, but different kinds of swards.
I think that's really important to consider that if you suggested to a farmer to go away and change all of his lays into herbal lays and expect to see all these benefits overnight, that's perhaps not what is going to happen. It's really important that therefore maybe take baby steps and just make small changes and see the effect of those changes, and then where it works on your farm to then go ahead and do more of it. And I think it's really thinking about going back to the herbal lays, often get asked the question, well, what herbs, what legumes should I be putting in my herbal lay? And it's almost a case of, well, there's two options there. You could go out and try absolutely everything that the seed suppliers can supply you, or perhaps you could even just take a bit of a look around the hedgerows and see what's growing naturally. I mean, you can see there's certain areas where vetches absolutely love it, plantains absolutely love it. So therefore, it's a case of look and see, perhaps what's growing naturally is probably what's going to really survive and thrive in your pasture, and therefore really add to what you can get the benefit from.
Yeah, and also I think there's no sort of standard way that'll work for everyone. It's about each producer finding out what works for them. I'd say that herbal lays are certainly more challenging to implement within highly stocked systems, those relying on very high yield, sort of dry matter yields of grass sustained feed. That might take time to find out where herbal lays work for them, but I'd suggest try it maybe on a small area. But often it can take more than 1 year to work. Often plenty of people have sort of reported that the first year is sometimes disappointing, and I think it does take a few years for the microbiology in the soil to develop to really get the benefits from the different species.
And picking up there, Elizabeth, on what you were saying with different perhaps classes of livestock, it could be that you want to perhaps try a bit of mob grazing or a taller standing grass sward, and therefore maybe trying a herbal lay with some dry cows could be the way forward, that just sort of the class of stock it's not so drastic at that point of time in getting it wrong, rather than sort of perhaps at peak yield or the like. So it's just sort of sucking it and seeing and see what happens, really.
Certainly at the Women in Dairy conference not that long ago, one of the things I came away with was the idea that actually young stock are quite a safe place to try new things because they don't impact the bottom line in quite the same way in a dairy system. And there's probably slightly less opportunity in other livestock systems, but nonetheless, opportunities to think about where and how to target the things we're trying and to take those baby steps to try something, perhaps.
Definitely.
Cool. Housing and manure handling, a key part of livestock systems, all sorts of livestock systems, and I think, as you flagged up, Richard, an important source of methane emissions to be managed. Are there any particular things that might make a difference there, especially if farmers are in a position of thinking about updating or changing their systems?
Yeah, and obviously with the grants available at the moment for those that are reviewing their systems, I think reducing carbon emissions is one important factor, alongside making efficient use of the nutrients, primarily the nitrogen that's available there in those manures. Manure is a complex area from an emissions point of view. Ultimately, anaerobic digestion is one option to actually turn the methane in the manure into energy. And whilst in theory, you know, that's a definite option, unfortunately, not for most dairy producers at the moment, the economics simply don't stack up. So yeah, beyond that, looking at storage systems, looking at cupboard stores, etc., that have benefits in terms of reducing, or in some systems, capturing the methane emissions. It's also looking to sort of preserve the nitrogen there, so that from a sort of reducing imported nitrogen, again, top of the list should be making the best use of the nutrient resources in the manure that you have available.
I think there's one interesting bit of research that I've seen on sort of that manure handling, and really looking at how perhaps we can keep the urine away from the manure itself and actually stop that interaction between the two and the emissions caused by that. So you can get some very unique flooring systems that perhaps, you know, could be an option on some farms where they're perhaps considering changing flooring. It could be an option, but I think there's probably still some more work to be done on how we can separate slurry and urine.
One practical point to just make sure is to make sure you're testing your farmyard manure and your slurry, and also your soils, to make sure that you're matching the nutrients together, so you're not applying it where it's not necessarily needed and utilizing that to begin with. So making sure you understand what's actually going on.
Going back to your nutrient management planning, which again is one of those things that's available under the Sustainable Farming Incentive. So I think it's just over £500 a year for that. So it's worth thinking about.
We were talking about matching there, I think, nutrients in manures to what the grass and forages might need. But I guess we've also got that challenge of matching what our livestock demand is in terms of energy and nutrients, and getting that feed balance right. Richard, do you have any tips for me on how to think about balancing nutrient use efficiency and feed use efficiency on farms?
Yeah, I mean, feeding's one of the many areas related to carbon emissions. Is the most important thing is overall feed efficiency. And indeed, most of what all of us have been working for years in terms of improving efficiencies, reduced costs of production, making better use of the purchased feeds will not only save cost, save money, but it will also reduce emissions. And at Kingsay, sort of, we're a big believer of making more of your own resources, in other words, homegrown forage, growing that forage efficiently, and then making the most efficient use of that forage within the ration. And that goes for both the housing cow and the grazing cow. And I think particularly the grazing cow, there's plenty of research being carried out at the moment. And there's some interesting research that I've seen in Ireland at Moor Park that Chagas are doing, whereby where they're monitoring grazing cows, particularly on sort of high quality spring grass swards, they are recording significantly lower methane emissions from those grazing cows than the standard models predict. So I think when it comes to feeding, the focus is on making the most of the feeds available, but also looking at utilising purchase feeds with lower emissions. So obviously from a carbon point of view, soya can have a big carbon cost, particularly if it's been introduced in areas where there's land use change happening. And indeed, I think there's a lot of work the we work with the dairy manager with a lot of feed companies across the UK, and many of them now are able to give a carbon figure per tonne of feed for each of their different compounds, and they're pulling together different ranges without soya and with lower carbon emissions.
I think it's really interesting just looking at even the country of origin for some of these raw materials, that actually you can impact a carbon footprint of by almost half, just looking at where maybe the soya has come from. So changing soya from Brazil to US soya, and instead of palm kernel from Indonesia, getting it from Malaysia. And I think it's just, yes, that might be sort of fine tuning, but actually if it can have still that 50% of the impact of the feed can still make a big difference. And it might not always mean taking soya out of the diet. There's some people that would say that taking soya out of the diet really doesn't suit their cows. So it's then looking at, well, what can I do in that situation?
So there's also been some research looking at things we might add into some of those feeds. And it doesn't have to, it could be adding also into homegrown as well as into bought. But some of those feed additives, are there any of those that you think, or is it something we should be keeping an eye on, Richard, in terms of things that might be coming in the near future?
Yeah, there's certainly some interesting developments. I mean, in particular, we've done one study with a company called Mutral. They have a product which is a garlic and citrus extract. They've done research work with Lancaster University that has showed feeding that will reduce methane emissions by around 30%, purely from the favourable effect that that has on the rumen, reducing the methane producing bacteria. Now, we did a study where we monitored the feeding of that supplement on 12 different farms, and then monitored production, milk quality, and health instances. And we showed some positive benefits. You know, it wasn't significantly different. I mean, there weren't really enough farms in the study. But yeah, that showed some positive difference, including an increase in production and production of solids, and a reduction in mastitis cases. There's then other research, and there's other products available. I mean, one that's not yet approved within the UK is the 3-NOP product, which again looks to reduce the methane producing bacteria in the rumen using a different technology. Again, the research on that looks favourable in terms of it's a similar sort of 30% reduction in methane. But I think from an individual farmer's point of view, A, we've got to look at those as an interesting option, but we've got to be wary of any unintended consequences. And at the moment, they fit into housed rations that are going through a diet feeder, not particularly to grazing herds. But then also there's the financial costs. And at the moment, there's no real financial incentive for the use of those. So the risk is they bring significant costs to the systems. And unless there are greater returns that can be obtained through the milk or meat contract, then from an individual farmer's point of view, they're not viable. So I'd see them as an option, but I'd say focus on efficiencies first.
Richard, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, I think it's the fine tuning after you've got all your other efficiencies where they need to be. And I think, as you say, efficiency is really key.
So, Sarah, given you were the last person talking just then, you get the horrible question. Well, maybe not a horrible question. There's a lot of talk about diet, and actually that perhaps one way of fixing all these nasty greenhouse gas emissions from livestock systems is just if we as customers stopped buying so many livestock products that we started to cut those down or cut them out of our diets. How might that actually work at a systems level? And how what kind of advice would you give to farmers who probably get asked that all the time?
I was going to say this is one of my favorite questions, really, Elizabeth. I know most people probably shy away from it, but I really quite like it. And it's a shame that this hasn't got a video to it, because this little story works a little bit better when you can actually see me folding a bit of paper. So I'm going to start with a sheet of A4 paper, and if we imagine that sheet of A4 paper is the surface of the globe. And if we fold that in half, we've got our piece of A5 paper, which is the surface of the land, because obviously we can't really grow too much in our seas to be feeding us. If we fold that in half again, it's the amount of land surface that's actually habitable to human beings. So, you know, that's we're now down to our quarter of a size of A4 paper. And that piece of A6 paper is probably at the area of land that we can habit and farm. And so if we look at that, we think, well, that's actually quite good. We can feed our population of however many billion that we're going to get to over the next 10 years or so. And we can say, actually, that's quite a decent amount of land for us to be feeding the world on. However, if we cut grasslands out of that system, we're actually left with the size of a business card. We all know the size of a business card. So we can imagine we started with our A4 bit of paper and now we're down to our business card size. So we've now only got the land surface the size of the business card to actually be growing crops on that are crops. So unless as human beings we really learn how to digest grass and actually become ruminants ourselves, we're actually really limiting the amount of land we have available to grow food for ourselves. So I would say the answer is making sure we've still got our double-sized piece of paper and land surface to be actually feeding the world with. If we do cut meat out of the equation, we really have cut our food production in half. And I think that sort of sums it up for me, really. I don't know that there's any other way of putting it.
And I think livestock and particularly ruminants have got a lot of bad press over recent years in terms of their methane contributions and their supposed impact on global warming. But I think it's clear, and many of you have heard the sort of the latest research, which looks at treating methane as what it is, which is a relatively short-term gas. In other words, with a sort of half-life of around 10 years. And if we evaluate livestock systems under that new, what's known as GWP star methodology, then they're particularly within the UK, their contribution to global warming is significantly reduced. That was work carried out, led by Professor Miles Allen at Oxford University. And to quote Miles, I mean, his sort of comment was, methane from UK cows has not contributed to global warming since 1990. And that's purely largely down to the population of UK cows is not increasing.
So lots of useful things, I think, there for livestock farmers to take on board in their own thinking and to think about how to communicate to others. And maybe they'll get good at origami so they can do that demonstration too, Sarah. Your final challenge then, the three of you, is to give a sort of your top tip. You know, if you were talking to farmers who wanted to act positively to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in livestock systems, what would be the thing that you would really advise them to start with? And I'm going to allow Christina to go first. She might not think this is a good thing, but that means the others don't steal all the easy ones, Christina.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think my top tip would be to focus on health and productivity of the farm. And that, you know, affects your financial bottom figure as well. But everything that you do to make sure that you've got healthy livestock and productive livestock will reduce your emissions overall.
Richard.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, it's focusing on efficiencies. And we sort of mentioned several of them in terms of feed efficiencies, fertilizer efficiencies, and also young stock. Again, a big focus, many is looking to grow young stock effectively within a dairy herd. That means bringing them through to calve at 2 years, because ultimately from a carbon assessment point of view, they are overhead. They are not producing output. And when we look at carbon emissions in terms of per unit of output, the sooner and more efficiently we can get those young stock into the herd at the right size as productive animals, the sooner they're contributing and diluting the overall emissions. Overall efficiencies, but also then, yeah, do look at some sort of novel solutions such as with sort of herbal lay and overall grazing management.
Oh, you're going to steal my thunder there, Richard.
Not sure he's left you much, Sarah.
It's all right.
I, 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 I saved you to the end because I'm hoping that you're going to tell me the answer might lie in the soil.
It is, it is. So I firmly believe, like you, Elizabeth, that soil health has a huge part to play in our carbon sequestration. So when we think about our soils and everything that's good for our soils, that's then good for our forage production, etc., is also good for carbon. So actually, if we're managing our grasslands for our livestock and doing it well, we're actually managing those soils for carbon. So actually really thinking about best practice in good pasture management. So not overgrazing, not undergrazing, thinking about the optimal pH to then make the most of our nutrient status that's currently within our soils, and sort of really good grassland production. So above ground biomass equals below ground biomass. And it's those roots that are sequestering that carbon. Therefore, the more grass we grow effectively, the more carbon we're potentially sequestering. So it's all good. It's, you know, if I was a grassland farmer, I'd be thinking, yes, keep growing my grass and doing it well is certainly the way forward. And as I say, picking up on what Richard said, thinking about perhaps some of those diverse swards. And it could be that when we're introducing those diverse swards, thinking about sort of minimum tillage rather than going and ploughing up and unfortunately making all that carbon come out of the soils, and really thinking about how we can keep that carbon really within our soils by reducing those field operations. And even when it comes to our livestock, thinking about soil poaching, you know, when we get a wet spring or a wet autumn, just disturbing the soil even by poaching can be impacting our carbon. So really thinking about all those things that are good for our grassland management are also good for our carbon.
Excellent. So that's lots of top tips, but brilliant and a really nice summary, I think. So thank you very much.